Good afternoon, good evening, good metal. My name's Coop and welcome to the Spoken Metal Show. This episode is a returning guest. I promised that I'd get people returning and doing bits and pieces. I always say we should get them on again. Well, we're getting this person on again. Michael Randall, the Mad Spanner himself, returns to the Spoken Metal Show. And it's a really, this is a good episode. This is a really, this is something, you know, we go deep into like sort of comedy and stand-up shows and that type of thing. And we talk, and he's very, you know, the Mad Spanner's always been very honest and very open. He talks about, you know, some difficult things, you know, at this particular time of year when this comes out. People are having difficult times. They look back on their lives, they look back on what they're doing, they feel depressed about stuff. And it's a really wonderful journey that he talks about. And I told this to him that I think that a lot of people will get a lot from this conversation because it is, it's a journey. He talks about being at the depths of depression and coming out of it. And that's something that, you know, we need to talk about and talk about more, that, you know, things aren't always going to, you can move past it and there is an end to it. And you also know that it's going to come up and be ready for it when it does as well. And, you know, Michael's really articulate with it in how he explains it. We go really, really, really serious and really dark in some elements of it. But then, as is life, there's massive amounts of where we're talking just the fun side of what we do and the things that we do in this business. He does stand-up. I'm just starting to do my live shows. And he's, you know, a comedian and he's an artist. And it's really interesting to me to speak to people that are having difficulties and challenges, and then they're overcoming them as well, because I think people can get an enormous amount of power from that, and an enormous amount of value and use from that. So I hope you do too. There's some shows coming up that I'll be talking about very, very soon, the first of which being in February the 10th at the Outpost, where I'll be doing the first ever Spoken Metal Show sessions. Well, what are they? Well, it's where I get a group of bands together, and we do kind of like a Jules Holland thing. I'll be interviewing the bands. I'll be recording them. We'll obviously people will be able to come and see the bands. And it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to this first iteration of it and where it goes from that. Headline is Thrasher Tui, the chef metal thrash band. Who doesn't want to see that? 7 Days Dead and the wonderful Mortala as well are all playing. And these bands maybe you haven't heard of before as well. And that's why I wanted to put these on and shine a spotlight onto bands you maybe haven't considered yet or are just beginning on their career. So I think it's going to be a lot of fun, and that's going to be on February the 10th. I'm also involved in being the podcast partner to Dark Rain Productions, and they are a company headed by Renu, who's doing some wonderful stuff coming up now where there's going to be some festivals, some shows, and this type of thing. And I'm going to be talking with the people involved in that and Renu herself about how what it takes to put a festival and shows together and kind of what's going on within the scene and talk to those artists playing these shows. It's nice to be a podcast partner. It's something I'm really looking forward to doing and something that, you know, I'm open to doing with anybody. If you've got a production company or something that's going on and you want a partner to help do kind of shine a light on what you're doing and do shows, if you don't want to do a podcast yourself or you want to do any kind of bits and pieces in terms of promotion, I'm here in any way, as always, to help those artists, those promoters, to do whatever they can. That's some shows coming up very soon. We've already started announcing the undercard to it, so to speak, and that's a lot of local acts, which I'm incredibly excited about. We haven't even announced the headliners yet, and there's some great stuff coming up, but I'll get into that on later shows. For now, please enjoy my conversation with the Mad Spanner himself, Michael Randall. Ladies and gentlemen, finally we're getting him back on the show, because every show that he's been on or even been a little tiny part of has been something that you folks have enjoyed. So it's nice to welcome back the Mad Spanner himself. How are we doing, Mike? All right?
Hello! Yeah, good to be here.
You all right, sir?
Thanks for having me on. Yeah, I'm well. All the things all at once.
Yeah, is it just
positive feelings?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I saw all your itinerary for the shows that you're both playing as a band and doing your stand up. You're doing so much stuff. Like, I don't know how you do it, Mike. Because I've just finished doing my live show, which isn't really stand up. There's elements of stand up to it, but it's not really stand up. And to think about doing that, and then the next night or the next night after playing a band show and playing songs, my head would just fall off. I don't know how someone keeps that all in their mind, you know?
I don't know. I feel a bit like a jack of all trades in some things, you know, like with the music and the stand up comedy and the gig organizing and things, and I just lots of like how it's hard to keep track of, but I manage just about, you know.
It's now that's the thing, isn't it? Now that if you want to be involved in the music industry, it's almost impossible to be just one thing, to be just a promoter or just in a band or just do stand up or just compare or whatever. It's hard to do just one thing now, isn't it?
Yeah. If you kind of want to get into the whole social media aspect, then a lot of it is actually more down to marketing yourself. Yeah. My biggest gripe with music is that you're spending a lot less time as a musician and being an artist. You're actually spending a lot more time as a marketing person and trying to establish your brand, which is actually kind of, for me, kind of soul sucking and takes away. Getting involved with putting music on live and focusing on the live show is kind of what I'm all about. I really like the live experience is very, very important to me because, you know, it feel you know, the human emotions, being around a community of people, you know, instead of being isolated indoors, you know, because social media isn't, you know, reflective of reality and stuff, and the live experience, you know, it's real, you know.
Yeah.
And you're seeing those, you know, expressions on stage, you know, and you come together as a community, and you don't feel alone.
One of the things that, you know, that really impressed me whenever I've seen you, and I once referred to you as a one man mosh pit because I thought that you brought that much energy to the performance. But I remember a couple of shows, and I don't think you'll mind me saying this, some things went wrong. Some things didn't go according to plan, but they were the best moments. Now, you don't see stuff on social media go wrong, but accidents and people falling over. I'm talking about a show going wrong. You don't really see that. No one pushes. Look at the time I fell over. Look at the time I missed. No one really pushes that because it's seen as a weakness, if you will. But I thought that they were the best moments because the crowd were like, this guy's one of us, and it could happen to us, and that's a mistake. And you know what? Let's cheer him when it comes back on, and he did. And it made that whole gig unique and bespoke to that particular thing. And it just made it an event, and that can only happen live, right?
Yeah. It's funny. I forgot, like, a Liverpool show, I think, is that was the very first time I played solo. I've played a lot more gigs solo since, but on that one gig, I remember being quite nervous about, can I do this without a band and stuff? But at the end of the day, stage performance is kind of what I do. This whole thing about if there are mistakes, this goes off in a slight tangent, but like you sort of prepare yourself to have spontaneity, like you're practicing your instrument and stuff, and you know that you're gonna how do you play while jumping around all over the place? Well, you're gonna have to practice while jumping around all over the place. Problem is, when you got the adrenaline on the stage, then you might go a bit further, a bit more than you can at home, you know. So those things or those inaccuracies are things I feel. It can only happen when the audience are engaged in the performance. And if there's any mistakes, you sort of turn it into part of the show.
Well, I'm often reminded of Frank Zappa, where he would record all of his stuff, everything live he recorded. And obviously this guy's a perfectionist, so everything is absolutely on the money right. But when he comes to kind of doing stuff for You Can't Do It on Stage Anymore and all the various other projects, he would look for those moments in the set, be it a solo or a bit where a song goes a different way. And those were the things that he would pick. He was waiting for those because they only happened at that event, and they time-stamped that event with something magical. You know, so I love that.
Right.
I love that because you don't want to go to see a band and they play exactly clinical, the exact same set that they played the night before. That's soul-destroying, right? That misses the whole point of the spontaneity of live performance, right?
Yeah, I entirely agree. Like with Frank Zappa, he would go another step further as well with the solos. I don't think he repeated his solos, and recording was about trying to capture that magic on stage. I've got different backing track versions of the shows, but I keep on changing them for every single set, like different. Yeah. maybe if it's a heavier lineup, I'll go for more like a much more like, you know, I've got 30 minutes. I'm just going to go all out. How much can I fit in 30 minutes and have a bit of a frenzy, like go berserk on stage? Yeah. Or if it's like the one for the next one I've got in Nottingham in the Gooch period, you know, between the vagina of Christmas and the arsehole of the New Year's. Yeah, you've got this gig in Nottingham.
Yeah.
And for that one, it's more like a party atmosphere. So that's going to be a curated set. That's going to be a lot more, you know, a lot more talking with the crowd, a lot more talking about the
song. Is that kind of a set that's kind of like a bridge to a full stand-up set?
No, it's a weird one because Mad Spanner as a band, well, I say a band, you know, now, you know, like as a music project, it actually stemmed from kind of failing at stand-up comedy, right? I did stand-up comedy first. I did some sketch comedy as well, which is a lot of fun. It's called Boredom Killers, if anyone wants to check that out. It's like 10 years ago, 12 years ago. It's a long time ago. That was a lot of fun. But stand-up comedy, I did a lot of bombing on stage, right? I think I bombed on stage maybe about 40% of the time. Maybe 20% of the time, it was like the best feeling I ever had. And then the rest of it was just kind of a bit of both, right? But that 20% of that best feeling when you've actually got it and you're in the zone and the ideas are coming to you like lightning. It's a very addictive feeling, you know. So when I switched to music, that was where the humor felt like it was becoming a lot more natural. I could express my sense of humor a lot better through music. And I found this stage persona, you know, this all-out energetic sort of like I can let loose a lot more. That persona, that's where it all kind of put together with Mad Spanner.
Yeah.
And I only began stand-up comedy out off the demise of Mad Spanner as the band. Oh, okay, going into a nice like little segue into a story about the dissolution of Mad Spanner as the band and into... Yeah, so Metal for the Masses in North Wales a few years ago. It was just when coronavirus was like in between the lockdowns, you were allowed to have live music for a bit. Yeah. I think what was it, 2021? It was two. It was the one where Bloodstock was coming back with a 5-day thing, right?
Yeah,
it was that year. We were in the finals for that one with five other bands. And we were really excited for it. We practiced on our own, but we only got to meet each other once, you know, to get things rolling. But I think I spoke to you about that show as well.
Yeah, we did a little preview thing where we talked about it. What was interesting, as you'll get into, I'm sure, is that when we first did the preview, it was kind of everything was in place, and it just gradually fell apart as it kind of. Got to the actual show, didn't it? I mean, you carry on. I mean, you
that's right. The drummer had one of these like a beep, a track and trace or something. You know, you've been in the same pub as someone with COVID too,
right?
And because of restrictions and regulations, couldn't make the show. So what we did instead is me and Dan, the guitarist, we played as a two-piece for 20 minutes. I played the drums and he dropped the tuning down to make up for lack of bass. So we played as an instrumental two-piece for 20 minutes. But we still had 10 minutes to fill. And I had all these jokes from like way back and a few others that I'd written down through the years. And I was like, oh, I could do 10 minutes of stand-up comedy, you know. We were practicing right to the very last thing, and the stand-up comedy went well. This was a sold-out audience, all sitting down in a hall. So actually, this is a perfect venue for stand-up comedy, even if people can't mosh around for a music venue as a music event. It kind of worked well for a stand-up thing, and the crowd were very much on our side. Because of the circumstances of losing a drummer.
Yeah, they wanted it to work. They wanted everything to be good. They were like, let's put maximum positive energy into it. Like,
We're a lot better now between the drummer and everything. But at the time, we fell out over the things. There were some things about, like, he didn't want it to be, say, public at that time. And we did a public statement on it, and we kind of fell out over that, basically.
Right.
And tensions were way higher in COVID. Looking back, like, people were wound up.
Yeah,
like spring,
everything
right?
seemed to have like real consequence, didn't it? It's like, oh, this is the end of everything. And it was like, now looking back, it wasn't the pandemic was serious, sure, but because you weren't playing live, it only lasted a year, 2 years. It wasn't a reason to completely split up a band. It wasn't a reason to completely change your direction in life. You know, maybe just look at your direction in life and decide to alter it, but not completely change things, possibly.
Yeah. It's funny. We look back at that, and it's we're mates now, and we've made up. But it's like it was funny that that how tense things were because of that. We really wanted live music, or I felt like, you know, this is our big opportunity, you know, for Bloodstock as well.
Yeah.
But whatever. I walk under the bridge. The thing was is that from that experience. Fozzy, the promoter, he comes over. We're at Bloodstock, you know.
Yes.
He comes over to me. Hey, Mike, you know, it's down at Comedy. You want to do Petrifest next year? Want to do Petrifest? And I'm like, yeah, sure. Go on, then let's go. 30 minutes. Do 30 minutes of stand-up. And I said, yeah, as if I was just like hacking off my testicles and just offering them on a platter.
No,
you know, just like, no problem. Why not? But so I had 6 months to prepare, and 30 minutes is a lot of time.
Just for those that I've never attempted comedy, and I do consider myself slightly in the, I haven't really attempted it class, 30 minutes of comedy, like a stand-up show, is enormous. Most comedians have, if any, tight 10 to 15.
That's
some
correct,
have eight,
yeah.
Some have even 5 minutes. Most of the time, you go on at the Frog and Bucket or anything like that, or these shows or the comedy clubs, most of the time, it's if you're getting 20 minutes, it's amazing. 30 is a headline in stance for most places. 30 is, and the thing I mean, you'll speak to this more than I can because you've done 30 minutes, is the concentration to required to be on that is vast, is absolutely vast, to not only remember the material, which is like, imagine telling a story for 30 minutes. That's what you've got to do. But also, you've got to react to the audience. So, you know, two or three jokes don't land. You know what the audience is. Okay, we can't go down that dark humor one, or we'll have to maybe take a political stance, or we can't, you know, you have to roll with the audience. So you're remembering a joke that's 30 minutes long, and you've bespoken it and curating it for an audience. Man, I couldn't imagine.
That's correct, yeah.
Jesus, where did you start to write that then? How did you even approach it?
I had about 10 minutes that I was very confident with.
Yeah.
5 minutes that could do with some tweaking. So I had to write 15 minutes of brand new material. Let's say about 20 minutes of that Petrifest show was like brand new, never done before. And you're right with you've always got to try and curate this to the audience that you're with. And that goes not only with stand-up comedy, especially for stand-up comedy, but it's something that I've done now with Mads Banner with the music as well, depending on the bill, right? Like I said before, if it was like an extreme metal set, then I'm going to go balls to the wall with, if it's a comedy, if it's more of a party atmosphere, then I'm going to start to introduce the songs a bit more, you know, like where's the humor behind
it. Of course.
You
know that in advance. You can look at the bill and go, these bands are on, I'll change the set accordingly.
Yeah, yeah.
With a comedy one, you don't know till you've
get got about,
there what the crowd's
yeah,
going to
exactly.
Like.
Yeah, you've got maybe about 20 minutes or half an hour, you know, just looking behind the curtain and seeing what the age group's like. Is this an older audience? Is this a younger audience? You know, what can I change your reference? So, like, let's say, for example, I might say, like, smoking's quite cool, right? Anyone who doesn't agree with me, imagine Jimi Hendrix with a vape, right? Yeah. Now, I'd say Jimi Hendrix as an older reference, but I'd say Lemmy more for, like, for a rock.
Yeah, you think he
who
you
knows
go for,
who
like,
Lemmy is, you know?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
That was a lot of fun, and then I started doing stand-up comedy here and there, you know, honing like a really good 10-15 minutes since. You know, I've done two half an hour ones, and rock places are my favorite places, of course, because if a joke doesn't land, I can easily just like ride through the awkwardness, especially somewhere like Petrifest, where it's like, well, I'm like, give me 10 more minutes and I'm going to be in the crowd with you on the next act. It was very much like a community thing. And I didn't feel like I had like a lot of pressure to succeed or anything like that. It was just having a laugh. It was just, you've got the stage for 30 minutes and you're just telling jokes to friends, you know?
When you decompress from that show and you look back at it, do you watch the whole show again yourself, or... Like, can you do that? Is it part of what you do, or do you just go by memory and go, okay, that joke didn't land, that needs to end better?
I record every single performance, or at least I try to, and then sort of see what worked and what doesn't, what didn't work. You know,
and that's the other mad thing about it is the crazy thing here is that you can do this slot for 30 minutes, ladies and gentlemen, and he can absolutely kill it. So 30 minutes of Pantry Fest, and he kills it. You can go down south and play somewhere else, same 30 minutes, same pauses and bits and pops and all the things that you've got set up and pauses in between gags, and it can die in on its arse. And that's what's so fucking crazy about comedy is that, and then you can go to France or you could do Hellfest or Wacken and do a set there, same set, and it goes amazing. Next festival, doesn't land at all. And I'm like, what the fuck? It's like, this weird magic, you know?
That's right, yeah. Like, oh my goodness, what was the last one? The last one was probably my worst, and it went well. I internally, it was the worst one.
Yeah.
I was spending the day. I arrived in the city, and I saw these some of my friends, and they're massive stoners. So I was through the whole entire day. I was in this fog of a room, just hotboxed this in this room. And I never in my life believed that you can get high off secondhand weed smoke. Until that one day we left the house finally after hours and hours of just catching up and everything. When I was like, oh man, like this excitement. And then there's this sort of paranoid worry of like dying on my ass. And I was like, where has this come from? And then it's like, oh no, I feel like I'm a bit high. Oh no. So then I was like going, okay, no, it's all good and everything. And, for the show as well, the jokes landed and it was all good. But I remember feeling like lethargic, like the energy was like at 70% when it could have been 100, right?
Yeah.
And I remember coming back from that, going like, "All right, well, I've learned something about that." about that.
I think I'm only talking about a tiny experience of it. I think the people that do it really well, the stand-up people that I look up to and have seen and have thought are doing amazing jobs. They can almost do that in the set, that they can calibrate themselves as they go. I find it amazing. I'm starting to do a little bit. I find myself doing it a little bit because I can kind of see what's working and I kind of feel, I'm like, okay. And I'm getting okay at it. But the great ones, the truly great ones, can go from one joke and then move a joke that was at the end upwards, that move it right in the head, move it around.
You can go down another
path. And it's like, when you see it happen, it's quite beautiful. It's quite a thing. I mean, when I saw your set was one of those moments where I was like, and this is important, Mike. I saw that set and I thought that was great. And the comedy bits were all landed for me. I thought it was fabulous. And I thought that I should try that because that's what I do. You know, I do something akin to that. And it really gave me an impetus to go and try and do that myself. So when I was comparing the next time, I tailored it to a similar fashion to what you did. So I had music involved in there as well and played more to the crowd. And I robbed that wholesale from you, mate, wholesale. I was like, I see what he does there. That's cool. And that's what I'm saying is that there'll be people watching your stuff and go, you know what? I like this type of music and I like this and he's doing that. So great, let me try that. There'll be a lot of people, you will be a gatekeeper to this stuff because comedy and metal, they seem to be, you know, they seem to love each other. It goes round and round and we go from, you know, from all the way to the back of Spinal Tap through to Bad News, through to all the Tenacious D. And comedy seems to love metal. It just always seems to come back to it. It's always, metal seems to always welcome it. It always seems to, like, they see, metal audiences seem to have the best sense of humor, I guess I'm saying.
Yeah. There's a couple of people. So you'll get these articles from, like, some publications every year or two of, like, you know, Does metal and comedy belong with each other? It's always the same over and over and over again. You know, unless you're burning churches. Yes, of course. You know, it's because the po-faced nature of metal, you need that kind of release. It can be very easy to take yourself very seriously, especially when you're tackling sort of like, you know, heavier themes, you know, that exist in metal. You need to take the edge off. Like, I remember watching in Arctangent this year, I saw Conjurer and Kirsty's Metal Hands, right? Two very different acts.
Yeah.
And there's members of the band and Conjurer in the latter, right? So I watched this real heavy set, you know, that deal with a mire of depression. And then you've got, the next day where they're happy. You know, they're goofing around. You know, they're doing the little air guitar. So they're being corny and cheesy and stuff, but they're looking at each other as mates and having a laugh and stuff. And that sort of lends that sort of comedic sort of like if one's like the catharsis, the other one is, well, I suppose it's a catharsis in a different way. It's like, you know, you can't just be, you know, dark, heavy, all the things all the time. You need that you need that thing to sort of bounce off of.
That levity.
You need the light as well as the dark, right?
Yeah, we know that, you know, some parts of metal are ridiculous. We know that. We know that as metal fans. And it's probably something quite British, actually, that we know, because we know there's some elements that are ridiculous and some elements that are so dark and depressive, we almost are quick to spin that and point out how ridiculous it is. Like, metal fans are some of the most self-depreciating fans out there. They know some stuff is ridiculous and we're quick to jump on it. You know what I mean? Quick to make mockery of corpse paint and make mockery of battle vests, even though these are things with, like, you know, deep significant meaning within the metal community. We know that there's some elements of that that are ridiculous and some elements of that that people don't understand at all. And we're very quick. I mean, it's only recently I've seen people dressed as Pokemon and all kinds of things in the pits. We know it's what we're doing here. We're very quick to, we are very meta. We understand what's going on to the outside world. You know, it's very quick. And it just means the audience get, you know, irony and stuff like that a lot quicker. You know, I always feel that it's like, you know, metal constantly gets the shaft for being simplistic and Neo-Thandral. And in reality, it's very complicated and nuanced. You know, you think of progressive metal and things like that and how complex it gets. You know, the listener and the audience are way more intelligent than people give them credit for, I believe. I don't know if you could say that for other genres of music, but I can only speak for the genre that I speak for. And metal just seems to love taking the piss out of itself. It's completely comfortable with it.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I've always like been a little bit of a devil's advocate, trying to think of other things like what other genres would do the same thing. You know, jazz heads kind of like I don't know. Yeah, I agree, because there's loads of different kinds of metal as well. But that is a constant. You know, from even people into black metal can even can laugh at its extremity, as well as people into Devin Townsend, who are like just total goofballs, you know, just like the guy himself, you know, very comfortable being silly, you know.
I
agree. And I'll tell you what, like, the stand-up comedy with metalheads or rock audiences are my favorite, because I feel like I can kind of just get away with anything. And it feels like I'm just telling jokes with friends, you know, like There seems to be pressure when it's just like actual strangers and you don't know who, you know, you haven't got any like stereotypes you can sort of like, you know, like in, you know, not to typecast anyone, but, you know, like our older people or something, or these people look like a bit more posh, these guys look like students or something, and trying to, with rock, I feel very much at home with that and how the sense of humor sort of rolls. So,
I like it. I like the, one of the things I'm starting to do now when I compare, I like almost kind of challenging myself as well. Like, I can know, you know, you could say anything as a compare, and as long as you end it with an upward lift, people will clap afterwards. So you go, blah, 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 and everybody go, yay, clap. It's like, but I wanted to do more, and I found one of the most interesting things was the interaction with the audience. So if someone said something, I would immediately jump on that.
Yeah,
I would go over and I'd be like, hey, what's your name, sir? And he'd be like, my name's Paul. And I'd be like, hey, Paul, what's going on? And he'd say something, oh, this is the first gig I've ever been to. Brilliant. And that's like 5 minutes of gags. And I was like, this is amazing. The interaction with the crowd is something that I really like. I saw you doing that as well, the reading the crowd and listening to when people shout stuff. I mean, hecklers are like a treat for a comedian.
I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah.
Treat. I saw you doing a lot of that, and that interested me.
Yeah, because but like even now in stand-up comedy, that's actually one of the things I'm less comfortable with. And yet on stage with music, that's where I'm most comfortable
that's
with.
That's interesting.
So it's like I've actually taken the heckling sort of thing straight from my, you know, my music show, because like it's like doing music, you've got you no one's expecting a stand-up comedy show or anything like that. Yeah. So there's no expectation to make them laugh. You just do it, right?
Yeah.
So when there's back and forth and a bit of banter, then it's so much more comfortable, because you don't have this sort of this pressure to be funny, right? It takes that away. So when you're doing that in a live realm and then you got a heckler, I'm now welcoming it because that's like a perfect time to be spontaneous, right? People who are heckling, they often, they want to be part of the show. They want the attention, right? Mm. So give it to them. They're now on the spot, right? Now everything is heightened. Now they want you to make fun of
them. Well, it's like spontaneity is really exciting, isn't it? Spontaneity on a record or a live recording, when you listen to a live recording of a band, is really exciting. It's the moment when it's like, oh, it is real. It is live. It's not recorded, but someone shouts something out or something
goes wrong
or someone launches into a song to it. That's an exciting moment. Spontaneity is like something to be embraced, in the same way we talked about mistakes. There to be embraced as well. It's like it's somehow it makes it real. It's like snaps you out of like what you're watching and you go, oh, actually, this is live, this is real, this is happening right now, And I love that element of it. I still don't think that I could do maybe 5 minutes. I don't think I could do 10 because I don't really see myself as a stand-up comedian, but I do see the allure of it. I do see the allure of kind of like when it lands, when it's right. And you land at that first like ripple of laughter, and the best laughter when you say something that's particularly dark or close to the bone. There's a laughter, there's a slight pause, there's an ooh, and then there's another set of laughter. I should really laugh at that, but that's okay. So I mean, when you go out for the show and it's the band, and when you go out for the show and it's just you, is it a mental space is different, or is it the same, or is the connecting tissue about where your head's at for that?
That's a good question. I think there is slightly, but I'm trying to, at the moment, just try to think where that
for me,
where
for me is. I have to kind of, it's weird. It's like I have to kind of talk to people in the audience before I do anything, and I start to get a vibe of the room if I'm speaking. When I used to be in a band, I would almost do the reverse, and I would just sit in the back and practice the instruments itself and get me, it would be mechanical. So with the band, it was mechanical. I'd be like, practice picking, practice apart, all this type of stuff, check gear, does this weight rise the strap correctly? But all this stuff was mechanical, whereas the stuff that I was doing when it was comedically based would be more from an interactive point of view. So I'd be talking to people before I went on stage. I'd be talking to the last act that went on. I'd be talking to the promoter. I'd be talking to a fan. And it would get me into the talking state, if you know what I mean. That's the two measures that I would have mentally. One would be very mechanical. And the other would be more sort of vocalizations and getting the brain working.
Being
ready for the responses.
I think that's it. I agree. Well, I'll go back to your question. I've got that, like, I've got my fingers out going like tangent, thoughts to come back to. Are you a fan of like Henry Rollins?
Henry Rollins was the reason I started doing the spoken metal show. I got to see him at Wacken, and I raced from one stage to see him at Wacken. I watched him do his set, and I've been a long time manner, all the way back to Black Flag, all the way back to Rollins Band, and all the way back. And then he started doing his live shows, and I just loved what he was doing. And I never really kind of put it out there that I loved Henry Rollins, because it was almost like de rigueur. Next thing I know, I'll be getting a Black Flag tattoo. And opening up a coffee shop. It's like, I didn't want to fall. I felt like if I said that, everybody was into it. But now people have kind of moved on to other people. Henry Rollins was consistent for me. I got a lot of stuff from what he was saying, and I enjoyed it. At the time, I started to travel the globe. He was doing bits and pieces. He was at the end of some of his travels. So there was a lot of stuff that fell in sync with it. And I told him so. I didn't get any photos. It didn't strike me as being that guy. I didn't tell him that I loved him or anything like that. I was just like, thanks for doing that, what you do, because now I can explain it. So I did my live show a couple of days ago. And I think that some people go into that still didn't understand what they were going to expect to see. Podcasts and live shows of spoken word are very unusual. And it's Henry Rollins has been the thing that I've begun. I do what Henry Rollins does. He's not a comedian. He makes you laugh. Yeah. But he's not. Wouldn't stand up comedy. He's just telling stories that happen to be interesting and or funny. And so I adored him, and he was the impetus to do the spoken metal show.
Yeah, I had a feeling, because there's that, he does bridge that gap between comedy and storytelling in a very, very good way. Okay. So I got I got the answer to your previous question about the differences between the live stage and and comedy, right? And the mentality is very much exactly the same. Before going on stage for both, I want to unleash kind of hell. I'm pent up with energy all the time. And the stage is the only time where I can really let loose. And I can go for it. Like so with its music, I'm like, I want to show this audience that they're not ready for what's going to happen. I'm just going to do my thing. It's going to be a whirlwind. I'm going to go off and I'm going to be drenched in sweat and completely out of breath. Mm-hmm. Now, a stand-up comedy, it's the same intention. Because most comedy is very static. It relies on awkwardness and breaking through that awkwardness. And I'm not a subtle... my comedy's not subtle at all. It's very surreal and everything. Mm. And I'm often clowning. I'm often like a lot of the punchline or my physicality is like, I don't mind being extremely weird and taking all of that, right? So the energy, so compared to a lot of the comedians where it's a lot of still and a very more dry, I'm waving my arms all over the place and I'm standing on chairs and stuff and I'm screaming and I'm yelling. Here's the difference is that I don't live on stage. I can be slightly out of breath. I can just speak vowels, etc. Because as long as I'm trying, like the audience should get like a sense of like vicarious catharsis through whatever I'm trying to express. Because as long as I'm trying 100% in expression, they should be with me. Where stand up comedy, if you're not able to articulate your words, you're in trouble. You know, the jokes have to have, you know, a structure and a punchline. And if you mess up that, if I get too carried away in my physicality, it could detract from the sentences which are, you know, carefully worded, you know, et cetera. And if that falls through, then the punchline will also fall flat. You know, the premise has to be clear. So it's almost like the physicality is like 40% what a Mad Spanner show would be. But that's because my mental focus is completely on articulation, you know. Yeah. So that's the difference.
Mm. How do you deal with that? Because my mental state goes like this. So before the show, a couple of days before the show, I'm moderately nervous just to make sure that I'm all prepared.
Yeah.
The day or the day of the show, I'm a little bit more nervous then because it's like, will anybody turn up? But then the couple of minutes beforehand, it feels like the up of a roller coaster, and I'm still nervous because I know the roller coaster is going to fall down, but I know that the down part you're meant to enjoy that. And then I get on stage, and specifically with the live show, I get on stage and I'm totally at home. Even when I notice things don't land and things do and things don't, blah blah, I'm totally at home. And then about a minute or so before I know it's ending, I can hear the roller coaster making a click, 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 because I know it's coming down. And then I come off. And even if it's great, I think it's awful. And I immediately start the decompression lever gets pulled down. And I only think about the things that didn't work. I only think about the things that I missed. And it absolutely destroys me. And it's at this point when people come up and go, that was fucking amazing. And I'm like, I know it was. I know it landed. I know it worked. I was there. But that tiny bit I didn't like, that guy at the back didn't laugh at that joke, and that should have been funnier. That was too quick. Yeah. I didn't laugh. And I can't seem to, it takes a while for the circle to come all the way around where I like maybe 2 weeks later, I can listen back to it and go, you know what? That's quite funny. And that worked. And that's okay. That was all right. That was enjoyable. What's your roller coaster like?
Oh my goodness. These roller coasters are very, very steep. My roller coaster, like the time on stage compared to the time off stage is that I'm actually a nervous wreck, like anxious wise, and it's a weird one. I think a lot of this is probably to do with like a lot of mental health or like anxiety as well. Cause like the time on stage for me is a high, and it's like a time when I've got like, you know, where I can practice. There's only so much time that I can do the thing that I've practiced so much for in terms of disciplines and study and all these things. And you know, what I've been working on and things. So, you know, but then beyond that, there's a lot of depression. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of work behind the scenes and a lot of, you know, social media, and there's a lot of like, you know, you got to work as well. You got to get that money as well. Mm. You know, some sacrifices as well, you know.
Because that's the, you know, you talk about like holding on to that as well, and that depression is, you're not sharing that with four or five other people or in a band, that you could all feel that way in a van up driving back to from the show, whatever, and kind of almost displace that depression. It's you on your own as a performer, yeah, isn't it, sometimes? So it's like, it's the weight of all of that, and it's enormous. Yeah. That,
like, I have got I have got like a reason to go up there, because what I said earlier about the live experience being very important to me is there's that sense of community right now. I've spent we're going on to segue. It's going to go well into, you know, the album concept, the new album, Mad Spanner.
Yeah,
because that has been in the making for like 5-6 years. And there's something that's very personal about it, is that, you know, like that communal experience is very important to me, because I know that other people, I'm not alone in this, like that depression could be a real killer in making you maybe feel like you are, but you're definitely not. And I know that other people are, and that there's invisible illnesses that are across the room. So not with stand-up comedy, with Mad Spanner particularly, like I always play to a way that I'm trying to bridge that connection with people who are like, even if they're just fed up of everything, you know, they're just at the bar, I try to cheer that person up, you know. And like, that's all like the undercurrent 100%. Thing is that, you know, like I know I'm trying to perform to everyone in the crowd, make sure that everyone is part of the show in some way, you know, because that sense of not being alone or being part of something that's you know, some people might go on about like say religion, bringing some things to a higher power. I don't want to go that far. I want to bring it just outside yourself to another person, like connection to, or, you know, the community, just the person next to you. And I think that's really important. So I spend, this is basically like what I do, is like, I really, I love the stage live music, bringing people together. If I'm not playing it or performing it, then I want to facilitate it. I want to make these events sort of happen. What can I do to do these things? You know, because I know how important it is for me. So, if even a couple of people sort of come away, you know, sort of with a better mood from coming out of it, then it's already worth it, you know.
Well, it's the thing of, you know, it's the knowing nod. So what I mean by that is that, you know, we're still, even now, ladies and gentlemen, we're still at a point in time where you are meant to talk about your feelings, ladies and gentlemen. You're meant to put those feelings out there, and you're meant to be able to approach anybody and talk about these feelings. These are all things that are meant to be out there. Anybody will, you know, inbox me anytime you want, that type of thing. In reality, it's not as easy as that. For one, the person with those feelings maybe doesn't even know how to articulate them, where even to start, or even to how to put it in your inbox to talk about it, and having the, you know, and the personal thought and strength to do that. And then the person they're talking to may not have the capacity to know what to do with that, or even help, you know. And yes, we should be talking about it, but there's still that. There's still some stigmatization of mental health, unfortunately. There's still some barriers. So what, you know, what I think you're talking about there, Mike, is that someone sees you going and doing a small bit about that, and a small bit about, you know, ADHD and things like that, and these common things that we're finding now. And they go, you know what? Ha ha, that's funny. This guy's ace. Knowing nod. I know what you're talking about. I feel the same way. That's okay. That's a little bit of weight lifted off there now. I'm at this show and I've just spoke to Mad Spanner and he said something and I feel that. And they don't tell you this, you don't tell them that, but it's understood. It's a knowing nod. Yeah, I get it, mate. Yeah, I suffer as well. Thanks, man, because just knowing I'm not alone, that's a start. That's a start. And then we can start to have a bigger dialogue. And then I do it all the time at my show. I did a bit for about 10 minutes at the spoken show, but it was just me, where I literally put my entire feelings out there. I was like, I put a video out where I was like, I don't know how this is going to work. I don't even know if it's going to fail, but I'm going to try. because I know that if it works, it'll be really good. And if it doesn't, people will be there to support me. If it doesn't, I literally put it all on Front Street. And it's that knowing nod that, you know, someone might not say to you, I watched your set and I got this from it, but they will have got something from it. And that's like, that's a very noble, that's a worthwhile adventure to do. Because you set up shows, don't you? Is it...
Born to Lose.
Born to Lose. Is that promotions company then? Basically,
I'd say, like, it's non-profit. It began with me and Kieran Scott from Ash and Crown Death Collector.
Yeah.
And we were in Shrewsbury and we thought, you know, like... We did this birthday party for someone, got some bands in, Mads Banner played, a little like Unicorn, Dead Pop, and we're like, you know, that was pretty easy. We like on a DI thing, you know, if all the bands sort of bring like some amplifiers and drum kit each, we just go to a pub and say, look, if we bring people in to drink, can we use your space basically for free? You know, you just use electricity and stuff. You know, just buy have us a free shot, and all we asked for is just a shot or something, you know, to cheers. We did this thing every month, you know, and that was a lot of fun back in 2019, and we're still doing it now, just a little bit less often in a bigger venue now as well. That whole thing, Born to Lose, Live to Win, that's like the Motorhead lyric, right? And the whole idea of like the underground, the underdog, and we say to the bands that a lot of the impetus for this is that we're trying to put on the shows with the candor and professionalism that we would expect as from our own selves going to another thing, you know, making sure that all the information is clear, that we we've tried to foster an audience that everything is completely transparent about payment and everything. I think we put on at least probably 15 shows by now. I think it used to be monthly in 2019, and now we do it every 2 months, just because of our own time schedules and stuff. I mean, I live in Borth near Aberystwyth, West Wales, and a lot of these shows are in Shrewsbury, so for example, so you know, so to actually go to the time and put the leaflets out and you know get the word going, it's a little bit of work, but we've got time for it. It's always a huge pleasure.
Those kind of DIY shows and those like shows that you say, like where you just turn up at a place and go, listen, can we use your room? That sort of thing. They're probably the most important live shows for a band of ever, because that's the first time they'll play in front of an audience. That's the first time they'll play and, you know, have to deal with the live situation, you know, and it's hard enough to get gigs at any point, but to play it, you know, I've been very enjoyable seeing sort of first band shows, like, you know, and that's amazing to me when that happens. You get to see a band playing their first couple of shows and their creative point where they're kind of deciding what they are and becoming. And that's where the next headliners are coming from. That's where they're going to happen. And if someone doesn't give them a chance to play, where the hell are we going to get these bands from? Then they're going to have to be manufactured. And that's not good. You know, it's like I'm forced on us rather than organically generated, you know, which is what your shows would provide.
That's right.
You know,
That's exactly right. There needs to be a place for new bands to cut their teeth. We thought maybe not so much now because the list of bands is so long. We've only got one gig every 2 months to make it work, right? But originally we had 4 bands on the bill, and there'd be, let's say, a good headline that we know we can do a good 45-minute set. And these bands usually, we just know, we're just friends with, right? We can bring them down because we know that they're good to work with. They're not going to be a prima donna, and and they're going to be turning up on time, and they conduct themselves well and stuff. So, so we, you know, they come over and play for relatively cheap, but we'll give them a crowd kind of thing. That's and a good night overall, right? So we'd have a headline like that. We have 2 other bands that are in those sort of things. But then to open with, that door is basically wide open for any band. Like, we'd be talking to people in the audience, you know, like, oh, you know, oh, we're jamming with this person, etc. You know, well, you can open for this night, you know, but, you know, there's the opportunity there to get your practice, into live practice, you know, to open the show. Kind of thing. And I think that's very important. Now, we only do like 3... Often, most of the time, it's 3 bands now in 2 months. But because the list is so long of bands that, you know, can play, and it's a bigger stage as well, which means there's more responsibility. We don't do it as much. It's as in for brand new acts, we don't do that as much anymore. But I think it's very important. Even then, like, I'd still love to open up that fourth slot if they, you know, if they don't mind playing for 20 minutes
or
pay for petrol money or something like that.
It sounds as though the scene in Wales is booming. It sounds as though there's a real scene there now. Is that the case? Is it? I mean, from what I've seen, there's some great shows going off.
Where? In South Wales, it's always like you hear about these bands playing, like you say, you got Newport, you got Swansea, you got Cardiff, right?
Okay.
North Wales, you've got Wrexham and you've got maybe Bangor. Mm-hmm. Bangor, and between them, you've got Colne Bay. North Wales is kind of held together with duct tape, and North East Wales Productions, they're really holding it together and have been for a long time now. And the scene up there is tight, but it's sparse. And then Mid Wales, fuck all. I used to work in Machynlleth, which is like bang in the middle of Wales, right? In Powys. There was a live venue that I worked in for, just after COVID. I worked there for about a year, and oh man, so there's some amazing shows, but it's really hard to get a crowd in a population that was like 1,000 or something like that, right? And then rock fans or metal fans, when we're really into metal, right?
Yeah.
I had Crash Diet. I supported Anvil, which was incredible. You know, seeing that was one of the best shows I've ever seen in my life. You know, imagine that Anvil where the drum kit is like 2/3 of the stage. Right, you got their gear going down the corridor, down to the smoking areas and stuff, because it's a small pub, right?
Yeah.
And the place being like, of all the people who are interested in this gig, all coming together, the place was absolutely jam packed. Fuck the fire alarms and stuff like that. The place is closing down in a month anyway. This is like the big blowout, but the place shoulder to shoulder, real crammed in, sweating the thing, like people were trying to get to the smoking area. It couldn't because there's too many people, etc. People were knocking over the back. So I'm there, right? I've got my back towards their amplifiers, and I got one foot on their stage, trying to guard their equipment from people walking past and stuff. You know, people, I hovering over their pedal. You know, lips would come off the stage, waddle through, go right underneath the legs. Step on his pedal, go back onto the stage, play a solo, come back, waddle straight through, click. It was absolutely crazy. And to their credit, they said they weren't scared of, you know, off being that up close to the crowd and everything. It was of the what was his name? Rob Reiner? The drummer, like, incredible. One of the best drummers I've ever seen in my life, up there with Mario Di Plantia. He played like a drum solo and stuff. He was directly right next, like within a meter to my right. He's right there, like bashing away.
I don't know. Obviously, the documentary broke them. That's what re-brought them into focus and naturally. But you forget, like, I'd seen them a few times. I was on a tour that was kind of alongside their tour, so we would meet up every couple of shows and I would just say, hey, and I was like, you know what, man? I was like, that documentary, they brought you to the forefront, but you guys have got like a bunch of songs and you can really play. You know, really play.
Yeah, the drummer is not highly underrated. Novelty there.
You can really play. Yeah. You know, and I don't mean that as an insult. I mean that maybe people don't fucking realize that they can play. They were in there with all the big thrash metal bands. They were all playing and holding their own, sometimes even outdoing them. You know, it wasn't just that they were like, didn't make it and that was their shtick. They've got songs, you know. Chris Sangridi's produced one of their albums and it's fucking brilliant. You know, it's like, and they're still underrated, even though they, like, everybody knows them now in the metal community. Yeah. They're probably still underrated. So,
Metal on Metal is like such a heavy riff. And that was a lot of fun. But that wasn't just the only one. Like, these moments, like, there was, we had, Spike from the Choir Boys come in and there's a solo thing. And then he brought the actual Choir Boys in. You know, like this bigger rock band, you know, in this tiny, in a small village, you know. You had the Dragon Force guy, Sam Topman in Chop Suey UK, had a lock-in with him. Andrew O'Neill had some stand-up comedy. Andrew O'Neill stayed over a couple of times, lock-ins.
Andrew O'Neill's fantastic. You know, what they're doing with comedy is just totally inspirational for the same reason, you know, switching it to an online situation, and they're like, you know, just absolutely trying everything. It becomes wild, you know. Andrew's been on the show a number of times. Just enjoyable outlook on how to do comedy. You know, I get a lot of influence from what Andrew does. Like, yeah,
very interesting. So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And
what about South Wales then? So South Wales then? What are we talking?
It's funny because the train links in Wales are rubbish. Last time I went to South Wales was probably like 6-7 years ago. And because you can't just go straight down, you've got to go into Birmingham and then back down again, you know.
It takes
so long. So I don't know. All I can say is that with Mid Wales, like Machynlleth is no more, but there's a couple of gigs that are happening still, like there on occasionally. But Aberystwyth.
Yeah,
is actually like there's a lot of live venues popping up. Cooper's Arms, a Coops.
Yeah.
They got the Angel, you got the Pier, you got the Student Union up in the at the university. One more. Oh, the Bank Vaults as well, and all of these different music venues. That's five, right? And when I moved to Shrewsbury like 6-7 years ago, you know, before moving back in COVID, right, there was nothing going on. So I think this comes and goes with the students, but at the moment Aberystwyth seemed to be like the place for live music for anything. I wouldn't say for rock and metal, although they do exist, you know.
Yeah,
at the moment it's just because I do the Born to Lose gigs, and I used to do them in Machynlleth as well, and now I'm trying to get them going on in Aberystwyth if I can get the secure the venue. But the challenge is getting bands to come down from the Midlands to travel all around the way, give them a place to stay and everything, and make sure that they're compensated for their petrol and give them an audience. There's three big things for getting the band. There's a lot of things homegrowing here that are not necessarily metal, so I'm not going to...
How much does kind of like Skindred success play into things then? Because they're kind of champion... you know, Newport and Wales, and they're kind of championing that. Benji does an awful lot of great work talking about, you know, that they are from Wales and there is a scene, and, you know, they should. Is Newport,
Swansea, Cardiff. That's like, if there's a scene, it's all in South Wales, and everything above that, it exists. And I'm trying to represent, like, you know, like extreme metal the best I can for Wales, and try and put something of a scene together. But there's only so many... there's only so much you can do with the sparse population, you know, I think Wales has got a population of like 3 million of people. And then you've got metalheads. And then where are they? They're all in South Wales.
It reminds me of some of the US states, in so much as the big place is big, but there's not that many people in there. And the network links aren't that great either. Like Wales is like that. You know, there's a lot. It's all sparsely... kind of out there, and it's difficult to kind of, like you say, thousand people in the village, and you've got to get a subset of that who likes metal, and a subset of that who likes extreme metal, and a subset of that's three on a Thursday night, and it's like sort of all of a sudden you reduce that Venn diagram to be like, you know, a small amount of people. But it sounds as though, look, if you know, if live venues are opening, then that's got to be a good thing. It's a start, for fuck's sake.
Exactly, 100%, 100%. Tonight there's a Welsh speaking indie band playing in a Coops, and I really want to check that out tonight, because you know that's not even my thing, indie music, but it's a live venue and I kind of just want to support that, just so that music keeps on going in the area.
That's the other thing that, you know, it comes up a lot on the shows that people go, we talk about metal shows and go to metal shows and metal shows and metal shows and metal shows. But I go to other shows as well. I go to an indie show or whatever show, because live music's live music. You know, it can be incredibly exciting, even if it's the most exciting thing for me is being surprised by any band. Like listening to them and going, actually, this is really good, irrespective of the genre. That moment when it goes from a band I've never heard of before to a band I'm like, wow, I'm going to check these out. These are great. That's a great song.
Yeah,
I saw a country artist a couple of weeks ago. Doing a small kind of acoustic show, and I thought they were fucking brilliant. I was like, well, I'm going to check that out. It's like, yes, I'm the metal guy, and that's my du jour, like my music du jour that I love the most, that I always go back to. But sure, I like, you know, electronica and dance and stuff. Yeah. And all, you know, I like that. And you know, this brings us onto the album as well, as we'll get into it in a sec. But I like all those facets as well. And a live show to me is simply a live show. Someone is there, they're paid to entertain you. you know, do the best they can to get the best music that they can across. And I always give any band of any genre three songs. And if three songs, I'm still listening, you've got me for the rest of the set. If you haven't, and I'm like, well, this is something I don't like, I'll still have listened to your three songs and I'll go and talk to my friends or go to the bar or whatever it may be. But I'll give you those three songs, you know, because that's an open-minded view to listening to music, right?
Yeah, I entirely agree. And funny enough, all my music listening for the past few years hasn't really been much into metal. I'm finding a lot more excitement in finding new genres and how they're able to express something differently than metal, you know? They might be saying the same thing even, but in a different way. And again, live, they might conduct that differently as well. So there's a lot more things you can learn and then maybe incorporate in metal, even if it does not necessarily sound.
Metal's always best, I think, when it's in the gathering stage, when it's in of going outside the circle, finding something that's not in the circle and bringing it back in and incorporating it into metal. That is when sometimes metal makes its biggest leaps forward, I believe. You know, you get stuff like nu metal and rap metal. There's other stuff that kind of goes into it. You know, this comes up a lot on the show that, like, you know, when DJs started to come into metal bands like Slipknot and then it kind of influenced blast beats and things like that. It's always good metal when it kind of goes, you know what, let's have a little bit of a look out of the safe zone. And let's bring some stuff in. That's, ladies and gentlemen, it does bring us onto the album, because the album is incredibly complicated and complex in so much as that, you know, if you try to see the family tree, it's enormous. The album's called Sisyphus Happy. And I from the album, I listened to it, and then the stuff that I've heard and the picture on the cover, the wonderful picture on the cover as well, by the way, that's a fucking great design. That is a T-shirt. All the live long day is like the story of Sisyphus. Now, the way I know the story of Sisyphus is through the Filmation cartoon Ulysses 31, is it?
Ooh.
And at one episode in that, a guy's punishment for upsetting the gods is to endlessly try and crowbar this big metal boulder up a sand hill, which drops through a thing and then produces food enough for that day. And he has to do it again and again and again. If he doesn't, he doesn't eat that day. And it's this perpetual cycle, which I believe is the story of Sisyphus, is a riff off the story of Sisyphus. He will upset the gods, am I right in thinking? He upset the gods and they forced him to push something up, and it was an endless chain. Is that right?
There's a lot of different interpretations of the myth. There's because a lot of them is that Sisyphus is actually not a good guy. He's actually like a bastard king, and he's just like... But his thing is that he loves life is a common occurrence, or he likes tricking the gods, you know. And then he gets his comeuppance with this punishment, and that's the thing that's been holding, you know, the imaginations, you know, or even of painters or philosophers and stuff, and you know, where this idea of perseverance or toil, or this idea of like this day-to-day thing you can't escape, right? Like, let's say, you know, like a 9-to-5 shift of work, right? Like, everyone knows what, you know, the grind of that, right? The grind, right?
Yeah.
I had this all started right from Mads Banner's inception when I had all these songs. Now, Life Absurd came out in 2019, but all the songs, well, most of the songs were already written for a demo album called The Wrong Shade of Orange. And I did all that by myself. It sounded like shit, but it was like my own thing, whole home record and everything. I bowed like a 5-string guitar and crashed out on that. But when I released it, and you know, to an uncaring world, I remember that was the lowest point of depression I've ever had.
Oh,
and so this is hinted at in the album. It opens with a song called Mad Spanner. Which has got a bit of, like, you know, talking about humor as a reflex, about the anxiety, the stage anxiety of putting on a show to an audience. But it also hints at that time on that day where I was over the other side of a bridge and I was like at my suicidal point, and someone taught me from it and then talked with me for another hour afterwards. And this is a total stranger, right? And I think about that nearly every day, you know, and that's when the ideas were starting to take root about like having some like where what is this that I'm trying to express? Where is this coming from and stuff? And Like, I'm still depressed, but like, I've coped with that suicidal thinking that was there for years before. And I remember I read, I had this awful job in a taxi company. I was like, but the best thing about it is that you had like the internet access. So you can, I remember I was reading all different kinds of existentialist philosophy, but there was one on absurdism with Albert Camus. And I read the an essay, The Myth of Sisyphus, actually The Myth of Sisyphus is actually the last song on the album. I do a spoken word off that whole essay in that, and it moved me. I had to go downstairs to the toilet and I had to do a cry. It really moved me to a point where it resonated so much. And from then I kind of framed my own mental, I can't say this for anyone else, but like it framed my own sort of like depression in a way where I don't want to die or anything like that. And I do want to have it, like, even if I'm kind of miserable, there's not a lot of happiness. There's like, I don't know, maybe there's like a stoicism of trying to offer something to society or something that's fulfilling or satisfying or yeah, something like that. Right. One must imagine Sisyphus happy, you know, imagining this sort of toil, but imagining like how could that be framed in a sort of like a good thing. So whatever it is, even if I'm like stuck in a really horrible job, I want to make the best of it. I want to maybe, well, how can I entertain people in this? How can I have the most fun? What can I get away with in the parameters of this box that I'm stuck in?
Yeah. Right?
Because a lot of my time is on these creative endeavors, and you know, work to me, it's like, although I could be qualified to doing something else, and I'm just always in part-time minimum wage work, so it's the hours and then doing this other thing on this, all these other things on the side, right? So that's like the sort of the undercurrent concept for the album, and the big challenge of it was how to have these sort of sincere themes, not about suicide, about like, there's a little bit of like this sort of cathartic sort of thing, part two in there, but also and not like a look at me kind of things. It's more about like just sort of tackling it as a philosophical concept, right? How do you have that while also doing songs about condom snapping, right?
Yeah.
It was about a 6-year like endeavor, right? We learned back in the gym as a band, but when the band sort of dissolved, it was my own thing. I still had all these riffs, I still had all these songs, and it was just that last one, Sisyphus Happy. How do I express this whole journey from then till now, where I'm playing gigs all over the place, and I've made new friends, and my anxiety seems to have gone away. Like, I still feel nervous, but like the bad side of it, you know, the real nerves. Yeah. Now I'm looking forward to going to this and meeting people, and the energy that's coming out, I just let it out. You know, I'm no longer like terrified talking to people I admire, you know, and just talking about them. Now I own it. Right.
Well, if anything, you like what you're saying, you've attacked the pillars of that. You've attacked the principles of anxiety and what that you've took away the blocks that give it strength and attacked its whole form from a, like, you know, an existential point of view. It's like, you know, what makes this up and why is this a thing, and attack that and kind of almost demystified it for yourself and say, listen, it's not that. You know, that's incredibly, you know, as someone who talks about themselves in their situation, like yourself, in very honest terms, and the nerves are always there to be seen. That's difficult, because it's like, you know, it's like having a small piece of tin foil in your teeth. You know, sometimes it's not even there, but when you do hit it, it lights your whole mouth up. But now you're like, well, I know what it is now, so I'll just chew on the other side. I know it's still there. Still there. I've got its fucking number, and I'll just move things this way. That's incredibly interesting to me. I think that, you know, that's the thing, is I think people that don't suffer from anxiety and depression see it as something that you can overcome, conquer, put in a box, see you later. And for me personally, it ain't like that. It's not something that you ever, I think it's like when they talk about people who are alcoholics, they say you always are now, you just learn to deal with it. Depression can have similar traits where it's like, it's never going to go fully away. You just learn that when it turns up, the black dog turns up,
yeah.
You go, I know what to feed it now and how to shoo it away, you know?
Yes, that's right.
I think that's it. That's incredible sort of, I knew that the album had those undertones. It's interesting though that you come seemingly on the other side of the album out of that and go, look where I am now.
Yeah.
And I've actually learned to, I think possibly Sisyphus Happy is gratitude and acceptance.
Yeah, the ending of the album was really, really cathartic to me. You know, that last chorus is, you know, writing those words down felt really final. And yeah, it's 16 minutes to get to that point of, like, you know, the day-to-day things that give me the small joys that I really want. They're really small, but they matter so much, right? And I, like, after all of this time, the 16-minute song, you know, getting to that point, it's all about those small things and highlighting them. I'm proud as fuck as of that song. Like, I don't know if I'm ever going to write a song like as good as that ever again, because that took a whole lifetime to write. And you know, I don't know if I'm going to say anything of more importance for myself or about anything really.
Yeah.
You know, I can take things from it and then, you know, make a concept. But as a whole, like, I've kind of, coming out of it, it felt like a little bit of therapy, because now it's out there. I've done a thing. And now now it's a different thing, because now this took so long to make and everything, and this whole dilemma, and I was obsessed with it. And now I don't have my baby project anymore. Now what am I waking up getting out of bed for? Well,
that was obviously the question, is that, you know, once you've slayed the head of this particular Hydra, you know, what's the next head? Does there need to be, for Mad Spanner, does there need to be that? Is that like a thing? You know, that's what we talk about when we talk about the tortured artist. In order to, some artists need to have strife and suffering and things that they have to deal with in order to create good art. And that brings up that's a massive debate. It's like, does that mean the art's better if someone suffered to make it?
I don't know. I think as long as the feelings are genuine, like as long as the expression is true, right? It could be like, say, you know, expressing this part. But if I was in a really happy place and I was, you know, talking about, like, I don't know, in the most twist thing sense, you know, love or friendship or something like that, or a party album. Let's say it's a summer party album, right?
And
these are songs to drink a beer with your mates to and stuff. If it's done, you know, with that sort of camaraderie and things, and it's true and everything, then it's just as valid, you know, even if they're not suffering internally, you know, as art, you know, as long as the feelings are something there. If it's a true love song or something, or
it comes from sorrow or
something like that.
I think that, you know, it's when, why doesn't an album or, you know, a piece of work have to be one tonality? You know, you say, like, the songs about condoms breaking. The songs about, you know, this stuff. But that's life. Life's like that.
Yeah.
You know, from the minute you wake up till the end of the day, sometimes it's amazing for 3 hours, then there's something shit, then there's something that makes you laugh, then there's someone that makes you upset, then you reflect for a minute, then you make a cup of coffee, then you fall over. Then, you know, that's real. That's what life is. Life isn't a continuous, you know, endless stream of beautiful, glorious experiences. There's all kinds. and that's the, I suppose that's what I get when I listen to stuff, especially your work, is that, you know, look, this is ridiculous, this particular moment. Enjoy the fact it's ridiculous. This bit's really serious. Enjoy that it's serious. This bit's really depressive. Enjoy that it's depressive, because it can be that way. It's okay for it. It's okay to be unhappy about something. It's okay to be depressed. But no, that the next circle, there might be something else. You know, because that's, I think, what drives people to do very horrible decisions whilst they're depressed, is they feeling that this will always be the feeling, that this will be, always be the way it is. And what I say to people is that if you can overcome that depressive moment where you think really bad thoughts and you can get past that, you've got to also take that when the good thing happens. So when you're feeling great, it doesn't take anything away from it. But in your mind, you're thinking, well, I feel great now. But it can't last, and something will change. It might go low a lot, or it might go low a little bit. But then knowing whilst I'm in that low, the good thing's coming as well. And just let that go, you know, let that ride all the way through the whole process. And it's hard to do. It's easy to say. It's hard to do. But knowing that that circle is coming up of it being better, worse, good, bad, funny, sad, or whatever, it's transitory. Yeah. All that changes is your perception, right?
Yeah, and all and yeah, there's always gigs around the corner to try and get you out of the house and sort of have some sort of sense of community that you're not alone, right?
Yeah.
For metal as well, like metal, with what they a lot, you know, could be trying to express the, like the dark times. You know, you can see that you know they've gone through these things. You read the song lyrics and stuff, and you know, and you can identify with some of those things. There's a bridge there, you know, and in many ways, you know, like. Metal's fantastic for this, you know. But not feeling alone, having a sense of community. When I was before like the Wrong Shade of Orange demo and stuff like that, and like when I was like really in a bad way mentally and not really having a good way of coping with them, the one bedrock of things where I felt like really like I had some sort of escape, some sort of reprieve from all of this was live music, you know, like heavy metal, right? And and because I know how much of a need of escape that is, you know, I try and bring that in, other shows in, like it's like this is a celebration of life. This is, you know, or this is gonna be a catharsis. This is gonna that energy on stage. I should play it as if I like it's my last show and the audience are there for the ride. This is the one.
Yes. Right? Yes.
And also there should be laughter involved. It should be an absurd 100%. Sense of, you know, it should be a good time. It should be fun. It should be complete catharsis of everything. There's a bit of antonym, so like a theatre of cruelty, just vicariously, even if the crowds themselves are not, moving, they're just like watching that, they can get that vicariously through my expression of just like throwing everything I can.
There's no greater takedown for something serious than comedy. There's no greater takedown. if you can laugh at something, you take all of its power away. If you can laugh at death and depression and how it comes to you, if you can just go, this is ridiculous, how I feel is ridiculous, and laugh at it and laugh at the ridiculousness of your situation, even looking back at it, it just takes all of its power away from it. Suddenly it's like, oh, that's all I had. All death has on you is the fear that it's permanency. And you're like, well, I know it's permanence. Shut the fuck up, death. I don't care now. Now I know it's not permanence. Hold on. I'm going to turn it on its flip side. I'm going to just do what the fuck I want. And death's like, oh, shit. What the fuck? I had permanency and fear as my only powers. And now they don't exist. This guy's gone off the fucking grid. He's ringing fucking self-depression and fucking loathing. And he's ringing them going, what the fuck do we do now? And the guy's going, I don't know. He's gone off grid and living his fucking life. And that's what your comedy does. That,
yeah,
doesn't it?
You are entirely right, Coop. That's a great analogy.
And people, and like you say, whether you're in the crowd doing, you're watching this and going to the show tonight and whatever it is, or you're playing and doing that, the roles are no different. The roles are no different. They're just kind of the energy's transferring. Yeah. That's all that's happening. You know, you go into a show feeling bad, but going to a show and then meet people you don't know, but they're all on the same page as you. They're all into the same music as you. There's a kinship. Almost unsaid. Even in the pit, it's unsaid.
Yeah.
And then when the house lights go down and you're all together embracing this band coming on, and they come on and play the first couple of riffs and you react to that and they react to you going crazy and they start pit. And it's all just transferable energies, all of which are positive. So, you know, going to shows for me, they're a cure-all. If I'm ever stuck for what I need to do, stuck for what's the next thing in my life, but don't quite feel as though if people have got me and my things are working out and all my ducks are in a row and all that other bullshit, I go to a live show and it's a cure-all. Cure-all.
I see when you're sort of posting these things on social media about the Liverpool scene. Oh, yeah, the Liverpool scene's dead. And then you sort of do a little pan in the venue and it's a complete packed venue and stuff. You know, it's really good to see when a scene's sort of live and kicking. Yeah. Maybe it was dead 10 years ago. I don't know. I'm just assuming, I guess. So I don't know where
that comes. Yeah, well, I mean, it's a good thing that came from it's comedy again. So I was going to shows, and then I was going to people in the council and people who ran promotions and people who did important things in Liverpool. And I was like, well, there's this great thing happening. Look at this wonderful, beautiful thing happening over here. And they would always say to me, there is no scene in Liverpool. So I would like that. That's the same thing. It's like, how do you deal with it? Okay, make fun of it and reduce it down to its bare level. So I would go to a show that was very clearly sold out, very clearly people were having a wonderful time enjoying themselves, turn to the camera and go, there is no scene in Liverpool, when clearly behind me there is. It's the old joke of on a police squad where the car goes into the firework factory and the fireworks are letting off the most wonderful display and there's police in front of it going, don't know, there's nothing to see here, move away, there's nothing to see, yet there's this wonderful firework display. It's the same thing. And I just became pissed off with people going, there wasn't, because when I was going to these shows, I was seeing the things that I'm talking to you about and you're saying, where I was seeing this energy, this wonderful dichotomy of people of all different genders and all different races and religions and all different persuasions all coming together and loving this show and enjoying themselves. And I'm like, don't you want to encourage that? Isn't that what we're trying to do as a society? Yeah. It's like all the bad things, these can be fixed by coming to show. Metal's great. Metal loves all. And if that's where it came from, you know, and yes, I do get people now shouting at me, there is no scene in Liverpool across the sheet. And I'm happy to be a clown for that. I'm happy for people to go, you know, what a silly man he is with his catchphrase. I'm happy because if they're going to a show, I'm cool with that, like, you know.
Yeah, for sure. For first show doing these, I remember the very first two doing this on my own. It was Liverpool and Manchester, the very first two. And I thought, if they don't go well, I might have to pack it in. I might have to just like, at least like until I find other musicians, I'll just work on writing or I'll work on something else.
Yeah.
But Liverpool and Manchester, Manchester is one of my favorite places to play anyway, but Liverpool especially was so friendly. So cool. Yeah. It's the first time I ever played there. And oh my God. Yeah. The accents. Oh my God. Scouse accent. Oh, loved it. They were really on board for having a good time. And I got on with a lot of people there. It was,
what Manchester and Liverpool share some commonalities is they both had really tough times. You know, they're both real working class places with real sort of issues, or real bad things have happened in both cities, you know, of all kind of levels. And the crowd just becomes more earnest. They're more kind of like accepting of entertainers and art, because they know that that's what, you know, that's what saves people. That's what helps people. That's what life is really about. That's why, you know, it's the old adage for both cities that, you know, the only way to get out of the situation is via sport or music. You know, you become a football player and you play for Man U, or you play for Liverpool, or you become a band and you come out of Liverpool, or you become a comedian. It's now comedy. It's now becoming a way out of that. And so the best crowds are the crowds that have seen how bad. Isn't that funny? You're thinking about it, Mike. The best crowds are the ones that have come the closest to tragedy and the closest to difficult times. They're the best crowds because they understand that gives their life for that half an hour, 2 hours of a show. It gives them a chance to escape, and they really embrace that escapism and that momentary pause they can have and look back and go, life, you know, maybe life's great, maybe life isn't as bad as we're told. You know, you go back to what Thatcher did to Liverpool is historic, you know, terrible things there. And it just meant that the crowds are more, you know, they love comedy and music and the arts. They love it. So does Manchester.
I'm inclined to agree wholeheartedly. Manchester and Liverpool, I've got those sort of history, you know, let's say some bad things happen. Birmingham, I'm thinking, is like the one other counter thing with that. I love Birmingham to bits. It's almost like, but it's like one of the most like, it's the most challenging place to play because like I sort of like you go on the stage, you're like, and it's just like everyone arms folded, you know, oh yeah, make me have a good time, I dare you go on, make me, you know, kind of thing.
You know, I mean, look, you talk about difficult strife, they invented heavy metal.
I know.
Anyone that invented heavy metal has had a hard... We don't get Iommi.
It's an absolute shithole, but I love Birmingham.
We don't get Iommi unless he works in a factory, as some of his fingers cut off and living in virtual poverty. We don't get Iommi. We don't get Sabbath. We don't get Black Sabbath.
No Judas Priest. No Godflesh. No Napalm Death. No Adolf
You don't
Mathrak,
get any of these bands. Ashen and Crowley, it's interesting even, that, you know... And all of those bands were formed from the same thing, where they were like, well, I hear people singing about, you know, fairies and daisies. That's not what I see. I see this, and I'm going to write about this. You know, you start with Sabbath, you move to Priest, and, you know, listen to the lyrics of Breaking the Law. You only have to hear, you know, how destitute and how horrible it was. And then you move to Napalm Death, and they're talking about, you know, political-edged stuff. And then you're on to Godflesh, which is like, utter despondency, you know, with Street Cleaner and songs like that.
Absolutely,
you know,
right for metal. Absolutely. Yeah. Well said. These industrial working class factory sort of places.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, here, near Aberystwyth, I'm looking out, there's a beautiful view of the sea. I look to the other side, to the train station, there's a little sheep and there's a chapel and stuff, and that's it. It's fuck all. So there's not a lot to complain about apart from the petty, you know, impotent rage of the day of stubbing your toe. That's all I got
to me. You know. It's just occurred to me that my stance on if you make fun of death and if you make fun of its power over you and depression, if you kind of embrace it and put it out with something else, you win against it. That's what those fucking guys did, didn't they? They took their shit situation, working all day in a factory and having, you know, no fucking, in Ozzy's case, no shoes on his feet. And they turned it round. They were like, you know what? I'm pretty sure other people think this is the way as well. Here's fucking Black Sabbath. You know, here's fucking, you got another thing coming. Here's fucking, you know, all these great sort of songs and albums and artists based upon being told like shit, but it ain't, because we're going to take that and reduce all of its power and fucking flip reverse it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely right. I'm in awe of the Midlands for that, for that influence on music, you know? I remember seeing an interview with Godflesh. It was like he was saying it was basically either the army, the factory, and that's it. But then there's also music as a little side avenue as well. Yeah. So he did that and it worked out for him, you know. And Napalm Death is probably one of my favorite bands of all time. I've got too many favorite bands of all time, to be honest with you. But Napalm Death is such an inspiration for, you know, at the age that they're at, but the speed they're still playing at and the energy, Barney's still going through, you know, it's incredible.
I mean, I've seen there were quite a few points in their career, and I saw them very recently. And I was blown away by several things. Like you say, at the speed and the ferocity at which they play is still there. You know, Barney's still there. You know,
but they mean it. You know,
yeah, exactly. And that they're writing culturally, you know, interesting stuff. They're writing about stuff that is of, you know, real interest. It's not, okay, well, these are singing songs about stuff that happened years ago. They're very, very, you know, politically sensitive. Mm. And, you know, the first time I heard about veganism was talking to Barney. It was the first time I was like, what even is that? And, you know, why is that? And why, you know, fascinating to me, you know, things about, you know, feminism and stuff.
And he's very articulate with his opinions as well.
100%. And it took a long time for people to maybe realize that, because at first there was a shock. When you first hear Napalm Death, there's a shock of it. It's a lot going on in your face. But when you actually break it down and start listening to it, you know, it's incredibly deep. Incredibly deep, the stuff to cover. There's a reason they covered, like, It's a Man's World and stuff like that. There's a reason that they looked at these deeper levels, and to be still doing that with authenticity and desire is hope for all of us, because it means, like you said, if you're doing it heartfelt and it's meant earnestly, you know, that art is it transcends time, it transcends, you know, anything else. It's there, there's a permanency of it because you meant it.
Yeah, I meant that at that point. I wonder, like, so with Mad Spanner, has it got an expiry date? Because it's so physical, and I do lots of stretching beforehand because I do get some injuries here and there. I pull muscles quite often and stuff. So it's like, as I get older, you know, it's like, like, when do I sort of gradually do that and just take up knitting instead, or whatever, you know, whatever artistic medium I would like to channel this into, you know, I'd like
that's the thing that, you know, that I think that artists, especially in metal, deal with
is metal drummers, arthritis, you know?
As you get to the end of your career, if you will, the body can't hold up, so vocally you will drop, you know, you'll end up tuning down and stuff to cover the vocals, you know, the live show isn't explosive as it was anymore, you know, it's like, how long is it? And then you get to that awful moment where it's like, when is it, is it making the performance less than?
But like, then you look at Napalm Death, right? Look at Shane, like he's keeping himself healthy and, you 100%. Know, like he's not an old guy, but you know, I think he's in his 50s or something, you know, but you know, still with the energy and frosty, like Suicidal Tendencies, what they're doing now, right?
Yeah.
They're no spring chickens, but they are going for it, you know, and that's inspiring to me. That's something that's like, you know what, you know, like, as long as you're looking after yourself, you can still, you know,
the other side of the coin is we had Lemmy, and look how he went when he didn't look after himself, and he still went for fucking ever, and he didn't, you know, by anybody's standards, look after himself, but you know, Lemmy may be the embodiment of what we're talking about, because here's someone who comes from Wales, essentially, you know.
Grew up in Wales,
grew up in Wales.
Yeah, born in Stoke, I think, yeah.
Born in Stoke, spent most of his time in Wales, you know, got out of Wales, you know, then did all this wonderful stuff before he even joined Motorhead. And then, you know, synonymous with speed and synonymous with bad things and drinking. But then he's wildly articulate and incredibly intelligent, and can speak on a number of things.
So glad you said that, because I mean, to the outside looking in, I mean, for the typical rock star, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but not enough gets spoken about Leo, his intelligence, or how erudite he was, you know, like that, you know, how many books he was reading, or how he could have an opinion on everything, a very good opinion on everything, and his general kindness, like that's way more important to me than the, you know, the infamous 100%. Rock and roll lifestyle, to, you know.
Yeah. Every story that, you know, they talk about, there's always the wild Lemmy story. Look how much he drank. Look at this, that, and the other. But I got to see, I met him on two occasions, and I know a lot of people work with him. And what you don't hear is that, I think Hetfield says it on the documentary, he's like, never saw him drunk, you know, silly drunk. Never saw him drunk. Never heard him, and I defy someone listening to this podcast now to send me a link of him saying something stupid that wasn't intentionally stupid, if you know what I mean, saying something stupid, even raising his voice or being angry with someone. I don't think I could ever see that. He was the quintessential example of how to act as a person. He was there for his friends. He was incredibly kind and always thought of everyone. He was very thoughtful. You know, people don't get that. And like you say, you know, you could bring up any topic you wanted, and he would offer not only an opinion on it, but a very well-read, well-balanced, and well-voiced opinion where you'd go, okay, maybe that's an interesting perspective. You know, he would, but also had the ability to listen to what you said as well. You know, I saw him do that a lot of times when he would just listen and then give and take it all in and then give a really concise answer. And that gets lost a little bit. Yeah, I think that people think of Lemmy and think of a certain type of Lemmy, think of the Ace of Spades Lemmy. But yeah, there was a what a life, and what an example of how to live your life. You know what I mean? Look after your friends, be true to the artistic form that you put out, you know, and don't take it seriously. His comedy was legendary, you know, his jokes were legendary, and how he perceived life, and try and do what you can before it ends. You know, try and do the things. That's a great mantra, right?
Yeah,
that's a
great growing up, like I didn't have much of a great, like, I don't know, let's say a father figure or something. Like, I looked at him as a role model growing up, you know, for those reasons, you know. It's like, you know, how to conduct yourself with people and, you know, or like, he was also a little bit of a loner as well. Not a loner in terms of, like, you know, but he felt very individual, you know.
Well, he was,
and that was very inspiring as well.
I would agree. He wasn't a loner. He was just comfortable with his own, you know, with himself. He could be in a room with 50 people and drinking and partying, it'd be great. He could be on stage at Wacken in front of 100,000 people and be comfortable and great. But at the same time, he could be left on the tour bus for 2 hours with no television, and he didn't really use mobile phones, and he'd be comfortable just reading a book or with his own thoughts. You know, there was a peace with him that he seemed to have figured out who he was and figured out what he was doing and his mission and how he was. And he was aware that, I'm sure he was aware that he was a legend, you know, and he was going to live forever in everybody's eyes. And that's just, that can be quite dangerous as well. And he was just, I think he was just happy with himself. And we've met these people, haven't we? Where you meet them and they're just comfortable in this in themselves. And you're like, there's an enormous power in that. When you see someone who's like, no, I'm not talking about confidence here. I'm talking about comfort, that they know who they are, that they're not, that they're going, okay, you know, this is who I am. Yeah. This is what I do. I know what's going on. And there's a power in that. And I was the same as you, mate. I was a huge role model for me. Role model, you know. And to see him, you know, at the height, some of the height of his powers was something. And I also saw him at the last Smacking show when he had to get air and stuff. And there was a moment where we were watching side of stage and he'd come round to get air. And there was like rock star royalty was watching the show because it was Vakken and they were there probably playing. But there was rock star royalty on the side of stage. And we all kind of just were like, that's fine. We don't want to see it now. And we all just went. When he started to get air and stuff, we were like, look, that's not our Lemmy, how we want to remember him. You know, we want to remember his job. He looked tired and he just looked like he needed a break from things. He would never say that, I'm sure. And it was just, it was sad, but we didn't want to see that too. We were like, let's just remember Lemmy for killing it and being amazing and still playing the Gasmatron, blowing everybody's head off.
Yeah.
So, you know, 100% I've seen him as a role model. I know Rollins feels the same way. You know, Rollins has spoken about that at all. And he's another one of those, you know, those people comfortable in what he is, comfortable being alone and traveling alone, but also comfortable talking to people and being around bands and stuff as well. You've just got to, I think I'm still on that journey to get that. I think I'm getting closer at nearly 50. I'm getting close. Do you feel some peace for yourself, mate? Do you feel that? You feel as though you're kind of getting hold of it?
Yeah. Close to you? I mean, no, but yeah. I mean, going from that, I mean, like integrity and honesty, as long as I have those things, I mean, I can be very comfortable with myself, right? So as long as what I'm doing artistically is honest and I'm, you know, it's coming from an honest place and, you know, and it, yeah, the integrity's held, then I'm very much it. Yeah, I'm very good with that. But I don't know, like, I'm a very sort of turbulent person internally, but I'm actually, on the outside, a lot of the time, I'm quite still and things. You know, a live gig or a venue, I'm off the wall because it's taken me like maybe a week or month or whatever to get to that point where I can let loose. But then I'm like a spring coil. I don't know. Yeah, it's a hard one. I'm not diagnosed with ADHD. But where do you get your energy from? It's like, well, it's like it's inside. Yeah. It's not visible to a lot of people. But So I don't know. I think I'm in a much better place than I was years ago, and last month I'm actually just getting out of that black dog thing now. Like, but
to say you're, last month to say you're was talking so bad. To you're talking to Michael from 2010, and you know now what you know, and you know you know that you're going to be okay, and you're on now on a show talking to me, and we're talking about passing that now and the album being out and that moment in your life being in the rear view and you've learned lessons and you've become a better person. What do you say to that guy then? You know, do you say to hold on there and keep on it? The guy on the bridge I'm talking about here, guy.
That's kind of what the album is kind of like. A lot of that is actually, I'm writing to like my teenage self, actually.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
As like try to put that in perspective, you know, the Mad Spanner song, the song that opens it has got that in mind. And then the 16 minute long one, but there's also Uni Fuck Me Well and Truly, which is on the album. And that's also a letter, like that is straight up a letter to my teenage self. That's how it was written. So now I'm trying to play, like, if there's like anyone think we're going to university or just going in their first years in audiences now, you know, when I say that here, anyone in university or wanting to go to university, show of hands, whoops. And then, but that's not me being bitter. The comedy is like being bitter and trying to heighten that as much as possible. But that was sort of written in a way of like, you know, that's towards me back then. Madman is like looking back at that thing and the So I think I don't know if how what I would say I would spend ages writing a song and then do it, you know.
I suppose it's nice that, like, you know, your journey is something that a lot of people will have had, mate. Where, you know, and maybe even ongoing, and they will listen to the album and know that that's an open letter to yourself then, and in many ways they can take, you know, I talk about this all the time, that someone's challenges can be viewed by someone else and help them with theirs, you know, and it's, that's powerful, that, man, that's a real power. Yeah, that's something that, you know, that only a subset of people have the ability to A, articulate it, B, the strength to put it down, and C, the conviction to see it through, that you can get it out there. Yeah, that's a, that takes a lot, that's a, you know, and I applaud that. I applaud anybody who does that. Ladies and gentlemen, it's like, it's, we could go on another couple of hours. You haven't even covered many topics. I think no doubt we'll be doing some shows together, because I adore the Mad Spanner. I adore his shows. I would suggest you check it out. The album, as much as we paint it as being, you know, it's quite a difficult listen, there's moments of brevity that are brilliant, you know. I love leaving Mad Spanner on when I listen to it, because one song's this, but then another song makes me laugh. The last time it was the put your fucking phone.
Get off your bastard phone, you antisocial dickhead! Phone. Yeah.
When that came on, when I had it on my playlist, I spat water out, and it's been a long time since I died, because I didn't see the title before it was just playing, and I spat water out. So as much as we're painting, there are some difficult topics bridged here, and there are some difficult sort of things, you know, approached. There are some great moments of levity where it's, you know, almost
Dark. I mean, most of the time that is the case, you know. The album is mostly that. But it just ends on a, it's just like a left turn, you know.
The two can't not coexist. They have to be there, because, like we talked about, that is life. That is the tragic comedy, as they say, of life.
Well,
and gentlemen, you know, we're gonna get we'll get Mad Spanner on again. It's always wonderful talking to you.
I'd love to come back to Liverpool. Thank you for coming on. Beautiful. Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me, Coop. This is a great conversation.
No worries, mate.
And everyone listening, take care of yourselves. I'll see you at another gig sometime soon.
Absolutely, for sure, sir.
Michael Randall there, the Mad Spanner himself. It was it's always good to talk to Michael. I always get a lot of kind of like power from what he's saying. It's a very interesting character, an interesting person, and it always makes me look at my own things that I'm trying to do, and if I'm worried about shit, or there's something I don't quite know what I'm doing with, or I'm unsure about if I should even do it and go forward and book a show, for example, you know, listening back to that is definitely going to give me some impetus to do stuff. I hope you enjoyed that, and it's, you know, despite talking about like kind of dark and depressing things, which these things have to be talked about, it's the way we kind of overcome them and take all their power away from them and change them into something more positive. And, you know, Michael talks about that really honestly, and I just thought it was really nice to sit down and have a longer conversation. Last time we spoke, we didn't speak that long. This one was much longer. So it's a deep dive, and I've got some great shows coming up in the new year now, where I've been getting all my ducks in a row and interviewing people. And that's what I'm interested in talking about. I'm talking about people's journeys and the things they're doing and how involved their life and things that they're involved in. And I think that's what you want to hear as well, judging by the feedback that I get, is you want to hear about interesting people doing cool things with metal as something of a backdrop, you know. And so there are people who would like to come on the show, or you want me to come onto your show and we can talk on that as well, please, you know, get in touch. I hope you're enjoying the show. I hope you're enjoying what it's becoming. The last episode I did with MJM was one of the most listened to episodes I've ever done. And so I'm really grateful that's happened, that people are listening and enjoying, and it's increasing the listenership, so more people can get to hear what I relatively positive message that I'm trying to give. There's some great shows coming up at the beginning of this new year. February in particular will be possibly the greatest year for metal in my community, in my city, in my area that there's ever been. So there's going to be lots and lots of things coming for that. I'm really looking forward to that. It's going to be a really great sort of start to the year as well, which is fantastic. I hope yours is as well. And I hope you enjoyed what you heard today. Once again, thanks for listening, and I'll see you at the show.